Last week, a week ago today, in fact, the U.S. government announced that a cow in Washington state had tested positive for mad cow disease. It is the first time the disease has been reported in this country. You'll probably recall that back in the mid-1990s, there was a very serious outbreak of mad cow disease in England. It also spread to Europe and to Asia. As a result, millions of cows were destroyed. Scientists also believe that a related disease, a human form of this disease, killed more than 140 people, mostly in Britain, who ate meat products from infected animals. So there certainly is a concern about the possibility of mad cow here in the United States, what it means for human health and what it means for the livestock industry. We thought that this would be a good opportunity to talk a little bit about mad cow disease and to review what it is, what causes it, how it spread, and what it is that we are doing to try to control the spread of the disease. And for that, we have this morning with us on the program, Philip Yam. He's a writer for Scientific American. He's been working for the magazine since 1989. Currently, he's the magazine's news editor. He's the author of a recently published book that we discussed on this program back in June. The title is The Pathological Protein, Mad Cow, Chronic Wasting, and Other Deadly Prion Diseases. This book is published by Copernicus. It came out in June, and it's an account of how it is that scientists gradually put together the pieces of this puzzle to understand what mad cow disease was and what caused it and how it was spread. So if you're interested in reading that story, and it is quite an interesting story, you can head down to the bookstore and look for the book. And of course, as we talk here this morning, questions are welcome. If you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line, and that means if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana over the air, or you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Yam, hello.
Yes, hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us again. We certainly appreciate it.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Well, just again, what I thought we should do is review some of the basics about mad cow disease and the other related kind of diseases. And maybe a point to start is to talk about what it is that causes these diseases. This was one of the things that we learned eventually,
right.
And that it was something of a mystery. It's quite interesting from a scientific perspective because this is an infectious disease, but the agent that causes the disease, it's not a bacteria, it's not a virus. It's something else.
Right. It's not a fungus or mold. It's actually a protein, and a protein that is thought to be called a prion for proteinaceous infectious particle. We now know that basically the prion exists naturally in all animals. What happens, the way it causes diseases, is that it somehow misfolds into a different pathogenic state. And in this pathogenic state can convert other normal prion proteins to adopt its malformed shape and therefore go on to cause disease.
And there are a number of these diseases that occur in particular animals. So we know that it can spread from one animal
right.
of the same species. But of course, the other thing that we have learned is that it can go from one species to another and produce similar kinds of symptoms. And the reason that these are called spongiform diseases, it is what after the animal has died, if you take a look at the brain of the animal, or it can be also a person, you see that it has a kind of a spongy appearance.
Right. The agent seems to pepper the brain full of holes, and that's why you see a lot of neurological symptoms in mad cows. They just kind of stagger around. They'll charge at their handlers. And you're right. This is a disease that's been known for a while in animals, and actually the first animal to was in sheep, and they called the disease back in the 17th century scrapie because the animal would basically scrape its fleece off. It would just basically act strangely. And in the UK, the emergence of mad cow disease is thought to have occurred because they contaminated sheep. The scrapie sheep were ground up and made into animal feed and given to the cows, which eventually ate the scrapie infected material and developed their own sickness.
And so the concern here, obviously, is that that can happen. Apparently, we also believe that a human form of this disease, that's called the variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, variant CJD, can also be caused when human beings eat some meat products. And we want to talk in some detail about what it is that's really the big problem. But we think that those people, most of them in Britain, that developed variant CJD, we think that that was the result of eating some meat products from animals that were infected. And it was probably that it happened in this way. It was back at the point where there was still animal products in the feed. So infected sheep were fed to the cows. The cows got infected. And then some of the people who ate some of that, then they got infected.
That's right. And you know, the peak of the BSE, the official term for mad cow disease is bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or BSE. And the BSE hit its peak in the UK in early 90s, 92, 93, before it started tapering off. And then the first cases occurred in young people around the mid-90s. And because the incubation period is believed to be upwards of about 10 years, they probably ate the infected meat probably in the early 80s. And that's why the first cases started dying in 95, 96. That 96 was an important year in the British government, because that's when they realized, hey, mad cows might actually be able to jump to humans, even though we've been reassuring the public that it can't.
Now, one of the things that perhaps people have seen if they've read some of the stories is that the disease-causing agent, the prion, seems to be in the tissues of the nervous system. So you're thinking about the brain, the spinal cord, things like that.
Right.
And that it should not be in the muscle that is mostly what we eat. So then I guess the question is, if you're having a steak from an infected cow, what are the chances that you would then encounter the prion and possibly get sick?
The chances are going to be extremely low. And the reason that a lot of scientists say this is because of experiments done in the UK in which they tested the various parts of the cow to see what was really infectious, what was prion infectious. They take bits of the spinal columns, various parts of the various organs, various muscle meats, and inject it into a test animal to see if the test animal comes down with a disease. Sure enough, the brain and the nervous system cause disease uniformly. The muscle meat never did. So that was the conclusion, that there aren't any infectious prions in the skeletal muscle meat, the kinds of things that we usually eat. Mm. What you'll hear now, though, is that there was a study coming out of University of California, San Francisco, that found infectious prions in the skeletal muscle of mice. These mice were infected, and surprisingly, it showed up in muscles there. Now, it's a big jump to go from mice to cattle as it is to go from mice to humans. I mean, a lot of drugs work well in mice and don't work at all in humans. But it's something worth looking at again to see if, whether or not cows might actually deposit infectious prions in the muscle. At the moment, the experiments say no, but rat experiments suggest that, it could be possible in mammals. But, I feel more confident with the inoculation experiments in which the cow muscle meat was injected to mice and did not show disease.
From the stories that I have read, the numbers of people that are believed to have acquired variant CJD from eating infected meat products, most of them in Britain, and we're talking about maybe about 140 people in round figures. Now, when there was the big outbreak of BSE in Britain, and then the connection was made between variant CJD and eating meat, the big question a lot of people had was, well, what are we going to see in terms of variant CJD as a result? And that was something that was very difficult to say. Now, now this many years later, if we've only seen 140 cases, one might think, well, maybe it's not going to be a huge problem. On the other hand, when you're looking at the long incubation period, you still have to say, well, we're not really sure. What's now the thinking ultimately the impact on human health of at least that particular outbreak going to be?
Right. As time goes on, it's good news, because that means very fewer people are probably likely ever to come down with the disease. So, I mean, the initial estimates, especially early on in the mid-90s, were that hundreds of thousands to millions of Britons would come down with the disease. And now that the number has not been increasing, in fact, maybe tapering off or flattening out at least, that's good news, suggesting that at least for some kinds of people, a certain population of people, that the infectivity was relatively low. Part of it is the fact that they estimate 200,000 cattle were found, about 180,000, 200,000 cattle were found to be infected with BSE. Mathematical models suggest about 1.9 million cattle probably were infected and escaped detection. So that's actually kind of good news because that meant there was a lot of infected meat out there and we're not seeing a whole huge increase in infection rates. So as time goes on, that's good news, but you can never really be sure about when these diseases actually manifest themselves. And in the case you can look at is Kuru, which is a disease of a tribe in Papua New Guinea. Back in the 1940s and 50s, especially, their society was being devastated by this basically a version of mad cow disease in humans. And that was because they practiced cannibalism, where they would eat their own dead as means to get strength from them. And they suffered tremendously, and it was only when they finally banned the practice of cannibalism in the late 50s that the epidemic started tapering off. But in fact, even more than 40 years after that has stopped, people are still dying of Kuru. That's the name of the disease. And that's amazing. I mean, that's 40 years. These people were probably just participating in only a few of these cannibalistic feasts and, as children, and now and they're elderly now and they're dying from it. So that's kind of amazing that this incubation period can last more than 40 years.
I have some callers here, and I want to get to them in a second. Let me just ask one other question at this point, and we'll see what's on the minds of the callers. Here now we have had identified in the United States one animal tested positive for BSE, and it apparently was a dairy cow that was thought to come from Canada, although the Canadians are kind of saying, well, we're not really so sure about that. It was one cow that it was at the end of the cow's productive life as a dairy cow, so it was sent to slaughter, and it was determined that it tested positive for BSE. One has to imagine that there's got to be, if there was this one cow, there's got to be more than that.
I think that's a good assumption. I mean, generally when countries have found one, they found more than one. They found many others. But there are a few countries in Europe that have just found one, and Austria and Israel are two examples of countries that have just found one. Mm-hmm. And Austria in particular is instructive because it was categorized in the same risk category as the United States. They tested hundreds of thousands and only found one so far. And so it's possible that we might only see one, but more likely is that if the cow was contaminated by feed, a lot of other cows shared in that feed, and that means that other cows are probably infected. We might never find them because they might have already been slaughtered. The betting line I would say is that there are probably other cows out there. Just how many is not known.
Now, one of the recent developments in the story was that apparently now they have decided that the cow was a little older than they had first thought, and that they believe that the cow would have been around before the ban on feeding animal parts to other animals was put into place. That was, as we have explained, what happened was they think in Britain that the cows got it from eating parts of infected sheep, and then the people got it from eating parts of infected cows. And so at that point they said, okay, well, we're not going to do that anymore. But this animal was old enough so that it would have been around before the ban came into effect, and that the thinking is that that's probably how the animal became infected.
Right. I think it's really critical. The age was really critical. And the initial reports that it was only 4 to 4.5 years was really kind of scary because that meant our feed ban rules were not being adequately enforced. Not at six and a half years old or so, it was before the feed ban was implemented. So you can kind of, you know, wave your hands and say, well, it was before we really implement these strict rules. The basic rule to keep it the agent from amplifying, the prion from amplifying, is that you don't feed the cows other cows. I mean, that was what really amplified the situation in Britain. You know, after cows died, they sometimes converted them, like the brain and spinal column in particular, to other cattle feed because no one else would eat it. So that's what helped really kind of blow up the epidemic. So that is, you can't do that now in the U.S. and Canada. In August 1997, they banned the feeding of most mammalian protein to cows.
And this is a disease that affects ruminant animals. So again, it's my understanding that there is no mad chicken disease, so that wouldn't be an issue. And that this also, there's no disease that affects swine like this?
You can experimentally give pigs the disease if you inject a bit of brain matter into their own brains, if you inject an infected sample into their own brains. Hmm. But in feeding experiments that they did in the UK, in which they fed BSE-infected material to pigs, the pigs remained healthy. So that's the justification for allowing pigs to still consume feed made from cows.
Yeah.
Chickens, no one has ever seen, same thing with chickens, no one's ever seen kind of a spongiform encephalopathy in chickens given through the feed, although there are loopholes and gaps. For instance, you can feed chicken litter to cows. Chicken litter is the stuff that falls to the floor, feathers, feces, and even the feed that you give. So in principle, you might be able to get the cow ruminant-derived feed that you're meant for the chickens back to the cows.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not believed to be a widespread practice. It's thought to be only on a few small farms, if at all. But nobody knows the extent of it. But the thing is, it's not illegal.
We're talking this morning with Philip Yam. He is the news editor for Scientific American magazine and has been working for the magazine for a number of years. If you're interested in reading on this subject, he wrote a very interesting book that's titled The Pathological Protein, which was about how it is the scientists figured out what caused mad cow and how it was transmitted and the link to human health and so forth. That book came out in June, published by Copernicus, so you can seek that out. Questions here, welcome. We have several people ready to go. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Also toll-free, 800-222-9455. First caller is in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Well, hi. I'd like to recommend some more reading for people. I read this out of Everything You Know Is Wrong, the Disinformation Guide to Secrets and Lies. It's called Bioterrorism and the Perfect Pathogen, Bovine Bioterrorism and the Perfect Pathogen by Gabe Kirchheimer. Excuse me. He raises a few interesting points. Like, for one, there was a hunter in Utah, I believe, Doug McEwen, that had... I guess you would call it variant CJV from deer and stuff that he hunted, and he donated blood and apparently was allowed to like be processed and go to 46 different countries or something like that. And as it is now, you're saying, well, it sounded like you were saying there's a low risk for blood transmission, but people from who spent 3 months in Great Britain are not allowed to donate blood to the Red Cross. And also, one other thing that I'd like to bring up, I'll just read this from the book because it's brief. In 1995, Dr. Richard Mark, a TSE researcher at the University of Wisconsin, investigating a mysterious outbreak of transmissible ink encephalopathy, TME, in the state, found that the mink's diet consisted almost exclusively of downer cows, animals too sick to stand. In March 1994, Marsh showed that when the brains of the infected cattle were fed to healthy mink, they developed TME. Healthy cattle inoculated with the tissue obtained from the TME-infected mink duly developed BSE. I'd just like to get your reaction to those two things.
I'm glad you brought up the mink part, because I've been trying to get an answer from the USDA about this. And the issue is that, is there an American version of mad cow disease, a native strain that exists here and has existed here for decades that we haven't really been able to find yet? And one of the thinking, and a lot of it comes from Dr. Richard Marsh's work with mink, is that, yes, there is such a thing here in the U.S. It produces a set of symptoms different from what you see in the U.K. Now, what's interesting about this cow they found was that it was a downer cow. And the main problems they could find with it was that it had hemorrhaging in the pelvic canal and other problems really associated with pregnancy. There was no obvious signs of the typical BSE symptoms of staggering around and acting aggressively. So whether or not this represents a new strain of disease is not, or an American strain of disease, is not really known. What they would have to do is take a sample of the cow's brain and then run an inoculation experiment, inject it into a rodent, and compare that with BSE material from England, inoculate also into, and see how the symptoms emerge. That would, if they're the same, then you can probably assume that it came from feed, contaminated feed from the UK somehow. If they're different, that sort of suggests a different game here. Another possibility, which you raised also with the chronic wasting disease in Utah, could also be the source of an American strain of the disease. The person who died in Utah did not die of variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. He died of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. They assume it's sporadic. They tried to find a connection with deer. Did not find it, but no one yet has ruled out whether or not chronic wasting disease, a prion disease of deer and elk, could jump to humans. Now, there is a worry that it could jump to cows, and they're doing experiments right now to determine that. So far, the feeding and experiments have not shown that cows can get sick from eating CWD meat, but those experiments are still ongoing. They can get it when they are inoculated with CWD into the brain. So in principle, yeah, they can get it. So whether or not this cow was exposed in some way to sick deer is not known at this point, but it was in Alberta, Canada, which is a province in which CWD has been spotted in farmed elk. So they still have to do that, those kinds of experiments, and I'd be really interested to see what kind of results they get out of that. The other thinking along those lines is that cattle get mad cow disease spontaneously, much as humans get Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease spontaneously in one out of a million cases. So that's certainly possible, but if that's the case, if cows do get it spontaneously, that means they've been getting it for decades and, well, it hasn't posed much of a problem in the past, then you might draw a conclusion that it doesn't pose a problem in the future. I wouldn't take that bet myself, but that's one thinking about it. But you're certainly right that there is hints that an American strain exists, but so far it's very difficult to prove.
I'd just like to ask about the hunter was only 30 years old, and
that's right.
From what I understand, that usually when people get random cases of CJD, it's in very old people, and often this is
right.
For Alzheimer's or something like that. Are
Absolutely.
There other cases of people that young?
Yes, they have been, and that's why the CDC erased the point in my book that several young people have now been found to have died from Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in a period from like the late 90s on, which is really unusual. And the CDC has looked into these cases but couldn't prove a link between chronic wasting disease deer or even beef with this disease. As far as they can tell, it looks like sporadic CJD. Yeah, but young people getting CJD is unusual. So when you find a cluster or in either grouped in time or space, that's something worth looking into. So the CDC does check whenever someone under 30 dies of disease. But yeah, at this point, it's hard to draw any firm conclusions.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Just again, to be real clear, we talked about the fact that there are a number of these spongiform diseases. You see them in different animals, and that we've established the fact that it can go from one species to another. There is this version called chronic wasting disease that you see in wild deer and elk. But it is not the case. I just want to make sure that have there been any warnings to hunters about whether or not it's okay to eat wild deer and elk?
Yes, there have been warnings about how to avoid the brain and the spinal column, and to make sure you decontaminate, clean off your blade really well, not to use the same blade you use to strip the carcass as you would to cut, the meat on the kitchen table.
Yeah, okay, so otherwise it's the same thing as it applies to cows.
Right.
The thought is if you're eating the muscle meat, that should be okay.
Right. That's the thinking right now, but again, chronic wasting disease is fairly... it's become an epidemic proportion in some areas of the country only fairly recently. So a lot of the tests and data are ongoing, and we really don't know what the incubation period would be in humans at this point.
Okay. Urbana next, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Yes, just one point first. You had said that it was a disease of bovine animals, and there are at least two species in this country that are not... a bovine, and the mink, for instance, the first occurrence of the encephalitis was, I believe, in the 70s, and in that case, it had become epidemic because they were reusing mink carcasses, which would indicate that there's some form of this disease that probably occurs spontaneously in a mink population, doesn't it?
Well, no one's really sure about how the mink got it. First of all, disease occurs in different species. Well, we're talking about mad cow disease as only occurring for bovines or ruminants. That was
right.
A special disease.
Right. But there is a quite
mink,
a wide
that's
class.
Absolutely true. In the 40s and 50s on these mink farms.
Was it that early? Okay.
Yeah, it dates back to about the 40s and 50s when farmed mink. And the mink were basically fed the scraps from the slaughterhouse. So it
well,
was
also they were
anything.
Fed mink carcasses.
It could have been, too. I mean, that may have well been amplified situation,
and,
but I mean, they just were fed a lot of high risk material. So it's, and we've had scrapie in the country as well, so that's also a possibility.
Well, supposedly that didn't appear until the 50s, but I don't really believe that.
Well, it's hard to say when, I mean, we had seen scrapies, I think, even a little bit before then, but by and large, not.
I was active in the breeding of purebred sheep at that time, so I'm very well acquainted with the situation there. But the mink, the control of the epidemic was from stopping the practice of reusing the mink carcasses.
Okay, that's we haven't seen a mink outbreak in a long time, so I think that's good.
But I do have two questions that I'd like some your best opinion on. Scrapie appears to be mildly contagious,
right?
And it obviously is not due in the 17th century to the reuse of refuse.
Right.
So there must be some means of communication.
Right.
This is also true of deer.
Absolutely. Other animals seem to spread it by other means. I mean, deer especially seem to spread it by contact with each other, possibly through the urine, through the mucous membranes. They nuzzle up with each other a lot. So nobody really... So yeah, it does spread between individuals. And cows, they don't seem to act the same way, and nobody's really sure why. But again, the presumed vector is primarily feed, and when in the end, we have the luxury of time to see how the UK handled their epidemic. And when they finally banned the feeding of cows to cows, the epidemic clearly started shifting. So clearly the feed was a major vector. Now, it's not to say that there are other possible vectors, and one was always the possibility of maternal transfer, that a calf could get it from her mother. No one's able to disprove that, but at most, based on the statistics, it only occurs at most in 10%, if at all.
We had thought that was the case with scrapie in the 50s. There's another agency there, of course. The one time that bovines and sheep are, in a sense, carnivorous is in the consumption of the afterbirth.
Right.
And that could,
that's absolutely,
even with
deer,
be a means of communication.
Right. The idea is that when they give birth, they can also drop their placenta on the ground and contaminate the ground.
Yeah.
We know that prions can remain infectious for years on the ground.
One other question. Does anyone know about the, CJD, isn't it? In humans, is that a prion disease, or do we just not know at present?
It is a prion disease. When you look at their genetics, and CJD can also be a hereditary disease, and it's partly due to a mutant PRP gene, prion protein gene.
Difficult to pronounce.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to avoid the acronyms that are common in this whole field.
Yeah.
But, you can take someone who gets sporadic CJD, you take a brain sample, you can infect another animal with it.
You can.
And then it's the prion protein.
I suppose manufacturing practices in the modern day have much to do with the possibility of it being, of the bovine variety being spread, where one animal's meat is intermixed with hundreds, perhaps, of others.
Yeah, the industrialization of agriculture and the changes really have made things unusual. I mean, agriculture is really unnatural for the animals. And,
oh, completely.
And some of the practices, led to unpredictable events.
One reason we may not see it developing naturally as often in cattle as we might expect, when I was a boy, we had cows that were 15, 16 years old and still fully productive. rarely does a dairy cow survive beyond 5 or 6 years today, and that doesn't give enough time for this disease to develop.
Right.
Well, I've monopolized enough of your time.
Well, thanks for the call. Just to follow up on one thing real quick that the caller said, and I think that there are some people that are concerned that there are practices now where they're trying to get every tiny bit of animal protein off the carcass of the cow, and that there's some possibility that in the process, some of that nervous system tissue that may have prions in it may indeed end up getting mixed up with the meat. Now, you're not going to get that on your steak, but perhaps if you buy ground beef, for example, something like that, some kind of product where meat is ground up and mixed together, then that might be an issue. Is anybody saying, well, maybe for that reason that there's a certain point at which we ought to say, we'll stop, whatever's on the carcass can stay there, or at least it's not going to end up in the food chain and in something that's for human consumption.
Right. The FDA and USDA have been kind of looking at that for a long time, and I know the FDA hasn't really decided whether or not to ban the use of brain and spinal material in, for instance, feed. But I would assume this case would definitely push the government to ban that. I mean, it's certainly possible that when you use these advanced meat recovery systems, you know, you basically use high-pressure jets to blast the meat off the remains of the cow, and, yeah, you can get spinal column material and brain material into especially processed meats like sausages, hot dogs, and hamburgers. Mm. So, I mean, they're even considering banning certain kinds of stunning methods of cows. Normally a cow is killed with a captive bolt or stunned with a captive bolt. A bolt is fired to knock it out. But what's legal still is the use of injected air where intense pulse of air is used to scramble the brains. But that's also been shown to be able to push the brain down the spinal column and into the bloodstream. And they've actually found bits of brain in, like, kidneys.
Hmm. Let's go on. We have a number of other callers. We'll try to get as many as we can. Next is in Urbana. This is line number 3. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I was listening to PBS, and they had a segment on BSE, and they had a Canadian official saying that there's certain parts of the small intestine that carry the prions, and I was wondering if you knew anything about that. It sounded like it was an early warning to what before they could even find it developing in the brain.
Right. What's really unusual, the portion you're talking about is called the distal ileum, a part of the small intestine, and what's really weird about this is that it shows up in very young calf and then disappears. So nobody really knows why. So basically they decided, well, we should just ban it because even though it's not part of the spinal column and nervous system as generally thought, it seems to infect it at least early on in the early stage and then goes away and nobody knows why.
Okay. Do you know what percentage of profit that we're talking about for the whole industry comes from this awful stuff?
I really don't know the details of sort of the rendering practices. They're very secretive. They don't really allow reporters to see the kind of the insides there. It's very hard to get in there, but I really don't know the numbers for that.
Okay, one last thing. Do you know how much of pet feed in the system has remains of animals in it? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
I would assume most pet feed is made of kind of just leftover animal remains, I mean, stuff we wouldn't eat. That, in fact, is how in the UK actually first saw evidence that mad cows disease could jump to other species. It actually occurred in cats. The first cat actually came down with it in 1990, created a huge uproar. It was a Siamese cat named Max, and they called the cat Mad Max. And it was created a huge uproar, but the government at the time denied that it was any connection. But later on, they realized, the cats were getting it from eating their pet food derived from cattle parts, and several dozen cats actually died that way.
Let's go to Champaign County. The next caller, line 1. Hello.
Hi. The UK seems to be very serious about prion transfer and our infectious ability of blood. I mean, the earlier caller talked about you're over there. But apparently they don't use their own blood currently. They buy it all from another country at this point.
I'm glad you brought up the blood issue again. In the UK, anyone born after 1996 gets blood from overseas. anyone, you know, if you're born before then, you're already exposed, presumably, so it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. But the concern is that, yeah, if you eat, if you're actually getting infectious prions by eating it, it's got to get to the bloodstream at one point in your life. So even if you can't detect it at this point, it was a prudent thing to avoid cutting off the blood supply for the people born after 96. And if you lived in the UK and Europe for a certain amount of time, you can't donate blood in the United States because of fears of mad cow disease. And they set the cutoff at 3 months, really, because that's the time that the amount of blood loss is what the Red Cross thinks they can make up in donor drives here. This really, it's kind of, in that sense, kind of arbitrary. If they could, they'd ban anyone who's been to the UK for any length of time. That would be kind of the super safe way of doing it. But so far, there hasn't been any evidence that blood does transmit the disease. So I understand the Red Cross and the American Blood Centers are getting to periods of chronic blood shortages, and you really can't have people dying just because of people not donating blood on fears of mad cow disease.
Mm. Well, I don't think it's absolutely true that there's no evidence of transmission through.
That's true. In sheep, they were able to transmit sheep disease through sheep through the blood.
So the prion is concentrated in the nervous system, spinal cord, and all that.
Yeah, I mean,
prion is just a improperly folded natural protein, I understand, and it sort of has. It has a bit of a catalytic effect, right?
That's right. So the idea is that if you eat infectious prions from cows, it circulates, gets into your bloodstream, then it piles up into the nervous system, where those cow proteins start making your own normal prion proteins misfold, and then it creates this kind of ice nine effect where the rest of your prion proteins start misfolding and becoming and destroying your brain cells.
What's called widely a ban on feeding to ruminants is not supervised at all. You mentioned that maybe small outfits might, but it keeps calling it a ban, and it's just basically it's basically a labeling plan.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, early on, the compliance with those rules were pretty weak. Only 25% were not in compliance with the FDA rules. And at the time, the FDA really didn't have much power to force compliance. It basically would send warning letters and then not follow up sometimes. But in the latest numbers that the USDA or the FDA presented, they found compliance, at least for their surveyed plants, to be pretty high. Only 1,826 surveyed firms are out of compliance, and that's pretty good. So far, at least when the FDA looks at the particular firms, they are following the rules, so that's good news. But we'll see how if they can get to 100%.
I'm not sure how reliable any of that is, because obviously they talk about how their testing program, and they test less than 0.01%.
Well, see, that's another issue, and it's true. The USDA did not test sufficient numbers, especially throughout the 1990s. They tested only several hundred downer cattle, which are the cattle most likely to have BSC. And in my own back-of-the-envelope calculations, I figured that they should at least test several thousand, and they only reached that number in the past couple of years, nearly 20,000 last year and a little bit over 20,000 this year. That's at a level where you can actually really detect BSE in a really one out of a million cases, and I think the fact that they did find this one cow shows that, yeah, we've finally gotten to a sufficient level of testing, at least just to find a disease. Early on, certainly, testing just a few hundred downer cattle was just you're not going to find it.
Well, speaking of testing, though, I mean, the UK, Europe and Japan is almost 100% testing.
Europe tests cattle, older cattle, over 30 months, because that's how sensitive. The rapid test that they use, that's basically how they can't detect anything below anything in younger cattle. It's presumably a young cattle is incubating the disease, but it's at such a low level that the test can't pick it up, so it's kind of pointless.
Which brings up this other test that I've just heard about. Do you know this test that was actually developed in Iowa? Mary Jo Schmier and Andrew Alpert and their, what's it called, hydrophilic interaction chromatography test for very low levels of prion. This woman investigator feels that she was ostracized for even suggesting that the USDA investigated, and it's been patented by the USDA, but it's been turned over to a private firm.
Right.
We aren't doing much with it here, but it's being tested quite seriously in the UK.
Yeah, I assume that we'd look at that patent, maybe try developing that even further. But yes, one of the great needs is for a live test or a test that can detect very low levels of the disease. And so far, I mean, calls right now to use existing tests for all slaughtered animals is really kind of pointless, because most of our cows are slaughtered when they're not even 18 months yet, way before any of these tests can pick up a disease. So you're just developing all these negative results and maybe get a false sense of security. But in Europe, they only look at animals over 30 months, which is more where these tests can reliably pick up an infection.
We have less than 10 minutes left here, and I have a number of other callers, and I hope the caller will forgive me for wanting to go on. I also want to reintroduce the guest. We're talking with Philip Yam. He's been writing and editing for Scientific American magazine since 1989. He's now the magazine's news editor. He's authored a book that explores mad cow disease and how it is we came to learn what it is and how it works. His book is titled The Pathological Proteins, published by Copernicus Books, and came out in June. If you want to look at that, you can head out to the bookstore or the library. Questions are welcome, too, here on the show. One quick question.
Yep.
The reason that this cow, particular cow, was suspected was when it arrived to the slaughterhouse, it was what they call a downer cow, which meant it couldn't walk or was having a problem walking, which gives you some kind of idea there's something wrong with the animal. So what they did was they took the brain and the nervous system tissue, and they took that, separated it out, and took samples, and then processed the meat. And I guess there are some people who would say that we ought to think differently about these downer animals, that maybe if we really think that there's some possibility that that animal has BSE, then maybe the downer cows should just be destroyed or should be separated, and that shouldn't go any further than there.
That's true. I mean, part of it is a problem with the definition of downer cattle, is that it refers to any kind of cattle that can't walk. So if it has a broken leg but is fine otherwise, it's classified as a downer cattle, even though its meat's probably just fine. The real question is why the USA still uses their kind of old-style testing, which takes several days to come up with a result, when the rapid tests have been shown to be pretty reliable. These were developed more recently, and they could have found out that this cow was sick in a matter of hours rather than a matter of days.
But you still don't think that it would be necessary to test every cow?
Not every cow that goes to slaughter. I would think it's worth considering cows that are over 30 months.
Okay.
Or certainly for downer cows, I think the rapid test used in Europe, which don't cost that much, should be used on those cows.
Bloomington, Indiana next, line 4. Hello.
Couple of more questions about prions.
Yep.
Why are prions called particles instead of molecules?
You can call them molecules. I mean, it's basically a chain of about 250 amino acids. So, yeah, it's a molecule. So it's a protein. So you have a gene for it that makes the protein. So, yeah, it can be called a molecule if you want.
Well, now, does a prion have any of the characteristics of an enzyme, like a rogue enzyme?
Yeah, and in some ways, you know, enzymes are also proteins, but it doesn't really, I guess you can say it has an enzymatic function in that it converts catalyzes some sort of reaction, but not enzymes the way you normally think about enzymes, which sort of boost the reaction speeds of chemical reactions. But yeah, you can consider it sort of has certain kinds of enzymatic properties.
Well, now, isn't it a legitimate function of an enzyme to make certain that a protein molecule is folding the right way, and if a prion is causing the protein molecule to misfold, to fold the wrong way, to assume the incorrect shape, am I correct?
Well, there are lots of other enzymes in your body that are supposed to ensure the proper folding of proteins, and if it's not proper, it destroys them. You're constantly making misfolded proteins all the time. The question is, why does the prion protein misfold and persist? And part of the theory is that our garbage disposal systems start breaking down. It can't keep up with the amount of prion protein, misfolded prion protein that is being made. So while normally our bodies can actually disassemble a misfolded infectious prion, people who get sick from it might not be able to keep up with the rate of conversion.
So there's a proofreading system that's saying, hey, there's a mistake being made here, let's correct it.
There might be something wrong with the proofreading system. I mean, the prion itself is not a proofreader. It really just seeks to create more of itself. So it's up to your other body's defenses to fight it off.
Well, now, are these misfolded protein molecules, are they the things that cause the spongiform texture of the...
It's part of the whole breakdown process in which for some reason, the cells no one's really sure what the prion protein normally does, but presumably it builds up in the cells, can't get digested fast enough in the cell, just explodes or dies and spreads out other infectious prion molecules, and that's sort of why, that's one working theory about why you see the holes. But I should also say that the prion theory is still a theory. There's other factors that must be involved to make the prion go rogue. It's not doing it by itself. There's enough experimental evidence that it needs some sort of help.
Did you say that the prion takes over the genetics of its cell and reproduces itself? It's like a virus, then.
It acts like a virus, and for years it was thought to be a slow virus. But what it does is doesn't take over the function of the genes and the gene production, but it just takes over changes the proteins that are already being expressed by the cell. So your cell is expressing normal prion proteins. A rogue prion will grab it and make it malformed.
Well, how does the prion itself multiply, or if it does?
It basically grabs onto normal prions and converts it to its rogue form. So then you got two rogues go on to recruit other normal prion proteins and so on and so forth.
Wow, how interesting. Thank you very much.
Good sure, program, you're welcome.
David. All right, thank you very much. We'll try to get one caller real quick here, line two in Champaign. Hello.
Hi, I grew up on a dairy farm, and every time I see that one clip that any news agency uses of a calf, an infected calf, you know,
right,
with the stilted walking with the legs splayed out front,
right, right,
I say, I have seen that before. I can
right.
swear we had calves that did that this would have been in the mid to late 50s. Is that
right.
possible?
There are a lot of things that can cause spongiform change in an animal that can create holes in their brains. I mean, toxic poisoning can do it. Some other kinds of inflammation can also produce those changes. So the key question is whether or not you can find the infectious prion proteins, mm-hmm. which we have tests for. You know, back then, it's certainly possible that it had some sort of mad cow disease back then, if you subscribe to the theory that we had an American strain that's been endemic and we've been living with it just without knowing about it. But it's really, there are other conditions that can cause an animal to do that.
Mm. Well, I remember it did not spread through the herd and the calves were put
yeah.
down. There were
yeah.
only maybe one to three of them, and my memory's rather fuzzy, so I was
yeah.
just curious.
That's the good thing is that mad cow disease does not seem to spread from individual to individual, but only by mm-hmm. feet. So if the calf were not really infectious to its herd mates, it would only be infectious to if it were converted to animal feed.
Mm. Another quick question: is there any relationship between Creutzfeldt-Jakob's and Alzheimer's?
People have looked at that, and the answer is no. Alzheimer's, the protein that goes haywire in Alzheimer's is different. It tends to be beta-amyloid protein and tau proteins. Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease is specifically connected to prion proteins. So they're different proteins that go haywire.
Mm-hmm.
And Alzheimer's has not been shown to be infectious, transmissible to experimental animals.
All right. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. Well, there we must leave it one more time. I want to mention that if you're interested in reading more about mad cow disease and what we have learned about it and how, you can look for the book that we have mentioned, written by our guest. It's titled The Pathological Protein, Mad Cow, Chronic Wasting, and Other Deadly Prion Diseases, published by Copernicus Books, was published in June by our guest, Philip Yam. He's news editor for Scientific American Magazine. And Mr. Yam, thanks very much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot, David. I also have a website for the book, www.thepathologicalprotein.com, in case anyone's interested for more information.
All right, very good. We appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
Thank
David.
You.